Hello, everyone, and welcome to Monday night's segment of Horsefly Chronicles Radio with myself, Julia Syracusa, and Philip Syracusa. We're broadcasting live from the
Segment of Horsefly Chronicles Radio with my
United Paranormal Radio Network on 105.3 FM from New Orleans. This evening's show is fully sponsored by Carnation, so we want to thank them for their sponsorship. We love them. You will have to do a few things in order to participate and chat. Go over to International Public Radio on YouTube and get into chat. Subscribe if you haven't. I can only respond to your comments on that YouTube channel. You can also go into all of the Facebook stations, UFO Paranormal Radio Network, UFO Undercover with Joe Montaldo, News on the Flip Side, also Twitch, SoundCloud, and Podbeam. Also go over to our group on Facebook, Horsefly Chronicles Radio. And if you have any questions for our guests, please ask. So today we have the most amazing guest. So please welcome Mr. Sam Sheeran to the show. Sam is a British dark artist based in Los Angeles, specializing in horror and science fiction. His work often includes elements inspired by ancient cultures, folklore, legend, and the occult. His fascination with the supernatural and the paranormal, cryptozoology, and the unexplained has played a huge part in his work since his own childhood experiences growing up on the edge of the forest in England. Sam is known as a talented cover artist for bands, novels, and comic books relating to cryptozoology. Sam's artwork is detailed and so real that it makes you feel like you're there in that picture experiencing that moment with him, which makes the most amazing artist. So you can see all of his work on his website, MrSamSheeran.com. So welcome, Sam, to the show.
Welcome. Good
Yay!
evening. How are you doing? Can you
Hi, how are
hear
you?
me? Good. Yeah, I'm great. I'm great. How's things?
Thank you so much for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Yeah,
My pleasure.
you have a pretty big resume.
Huge.
So, what we always like to ask our guests is take us to the beginning. Because this is a paranormal show, we're going to walk and skip through a couple of things, but let's talk about adolescence and any paranormal phenomenon you may have experienced.
Wow, where do I begin? Well, I mean, I was born in Liverpool, England, back in 1978. And I shortly left the area and moved to Runcorn, Cheshire, where I grew up until the age of 10. And during that time, I lived with my mom on the edge of a woodland in England called Murdershaw Forest. And it's one of those periods in my life where you remember a lot happening when you're 7 years old, more than any other year. And if I could sort of recap in 1 year of my life, that would be the strangest one, would be being age seven. So many different things happened. We had everything from giant dragonflies chasing you through the woodland and on the edges of the woodland itself, all the way down to ghost children walking into your room in the middle of the night and green fireballs flying around the ceiling. Very strange place. But then, at, you know, age 10, we moved away, thankfully.
Wow.
Interesting.
You know, everything always happens, you know, when we're really, really young. And it always
Well, it's
leaves.
because your mind is open
I was
and it
gonna say,
absorbs everything in the physical world. And
yeah.
then sometimes we have these spiritual encounters where, you know, when you grow up and you get older, you don't see as much because you're so occupied with everyday life.
Yeah.
But when you're young, you're absorbing it. And so, are you a believer in ghosts?
I wouldn't say I was a believer. I'm going to be a little pretentious and say I don't think it's a case of belief. I think the word belief has the connotation of religion attached to it. And it's really easy to sort of throw it all in one box and say, oh, I believe. But I think there's far, far more variations and layers on the subject of the paranormal in general that you can't really put it in one box and say, yeah, I believe it. Because you could say, yeah, I believe it all. But there's elements that can be explained. There are things that can be put into a completely weird, unexplainable box. And that's your paranormal. That's, you know, you have your legendary stories, your poltergeist situations, which can be explained. Whereas there are some situations where you just think, you know, you were there, you had that experience. There's no answer for it. So I would say I'm more of an appreciator and an acceptor that these things are real rather than a believer. I think it's very easy to sort of, even if you are religious, it's something that I think you shouldn't really put all your stock into the word belief and keep it very separate, because these things do happen. These things are happening. And that's not to say that there isn't a God and those things don't happen and those aren't real. They are very real to very, very many different people around the world. But the aspect of ghosts and the paranormal and the undead, voices from the other side, or whatever is going on, whether it's time travel, time slips, or just stains in reality, we obviously don't know for sure. To say you believe it is in one way saying, yes, you accept the evidence. But I shy away from the word belief, and I say that I accept that this is very, very real.
You accept it. Do you accept time travelers?
I'm sorry?
Time travelers. What's your thoughts on that? Do you accept that?
I'm on the fence with it, because on the one hand, you'd have to sort of accept that time travel can only happen in a sense that you can only go back to the point of when the machine was made, if that's what they're using, if it is a machine. You can't go back any further than that, because this is, you know, one sort of theory is that if the machine didn't exist, then you couldn't go back for it to function in order to send you anywhere or go forward again. So it's one of those oxymoron, conundrum, you know, all over the place ideas, but some people say that UFOs are the time travelers, and that's why we see so many of them, and that's why they never talk to us and they never land on the White House lawn, is because they almost, in a Star Trek kind of way, they have a prime directive where they're not allowed to interfere with people throughout time. So that's maybe why UFOs never talk to us or never land. And maybe it is us from the future. And maybe occasionally we do get abducted by time travelers, in a sense. And you could even say that, you know, there are stories throughout history and even in the Bible where people have been taken up into the sky and years have gone by and then they've returned and everyone they know is dead, kind of thing. And that would, in a logical sense, if if I can say logical, it's so far-fetched that it's hard to not wrap your head around, but hard to swallow, you know. Yeah. Talk about belief, you know, it's beyond belief, isn't it?
I think it's fascinating. And there's some videos out there I've seen, fascinating videos on YouTube, where the plane is in the sky and you know, it's not moving at one point, and then all of a sudden it moves, and some people believe we're in the Matrix.
Are you talking about the freeze frame jumbo jets where it looks like it's stuck in the sky?
Yeah.
I've seen a few of those. People have argued that it's the angle, that it's the speed of the plane. It's the same sort of thing as when you're driving in a car, the distance from a church on the other side of a field to you. That church doesn't look like it's moving, even though you're traveling at 80 miles an hour. You would have thought you would have passed it by now, but it's actually still there. It's just that it's so far away. And people have argued that an airplane, you know, you're talking thousands of feet above you, and at a certain angle, if it's turning, especially if it's turning towards you and you're traveling as well, it's going to appear that it's not moving. So there's ways to explain certain aspects of it. Although I did see, in terms of the Matrix, I did see a video on Instagram the other day of a man. He's in his car and he's filming the car in front of him, which is a convertible. And there's one guy sat in this car, in this convertible in front of him. And his reflection is in his own wing mirror, side mirror of the car. Rear view mirror, what do you call it? The side ones. I know in England we call them side mirrors, maybe. But his reflection isn't moving, and the guy in the car is. At one point, the guy looks down at his, you know, maybe he's looking at his phone, or he sort of turns his head and then turns back. But his own reflection in his wing mirror or side mirror, it doesn't move. And the guy who's filming this, and he's uploaded it onto, you know, I think it was TikTok, and it's ended up on Instagram. But the guy who's filming this says, you know, he's been watching this guy for 10 minutes and his reflection's doing something different. And I've looked at this a number of times and I cannot figure out what's going on.
Wow. It's
very, very strange.
Isn't that amazing?
What would you do if that happened to you?
I don't know. I mean, you do see these clips too where you see people from like the 1700s, 1800s. Some people might be filming a wedding, for example. This is out there in the public. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you see a person that doesn't belong here in this time and era running through and they disappear.
Yeah.
In fact, there was one, I think it was a football game last year on the field, and they caught something like that. It hit like millions of views. And they're all looking, and all of a sudden it's gone.
Yeah.
Just gone, the person.
It's so amazing what we can.
So I do believe, you know, again, you don't use the word believe. It's just where we, you know.
Yes, that we talk.
There's ripples in time where these things are possible. We don't have all the answers. I don't think we're ever going to get all the answers, but it is quite fascinating. And some compelling evidence. Maybe science can explain this one day, but for now, it's the question mark of what is it?
Yeah.
What is? And do we really understand and comprehend? Or is it just what it is? If it's black and white, it's black and white. Yeah. What you're seeing is real. It's really happening, just in a different time frame. You know, when we're paranormal investigators, when we communicate with the other side, sometimes we ask the questions, you know, what's it like over there? And we make up time. There is no time there. So it kind of leads me to this ripple effect where the interaction between their side and our side is more through the mind and the equipment of the mind versus the reality of what we try to put it into and perceive it as. It's amazing the answers that we get back. And there's so much information and knowledge out there that, you know, we never stop investigating because we do know that these things do exist.
It's so much.
Which leads me now to some of the work that you do. I mean, you're an incredible artist. And I have to ask you this question before we go into more details. Do you ever have prophetic dreams and then you draw the pictures from the dreams, sort of like a Stephen King?
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question. I dream all the time, and I have the strangest dreams. Sometimes it's too much to even write down. You know, you have a million thoughts at once, and you can't catalog it fast enough. And then, you know, you have your cup of tea an hour later, and it seems to just fade away, and it's all gone. But the big sort of... I wouldn't say messages, but the big sort of concepts and ideas that I do pull from dreams, I'd keep them in a filing cabinet in my mind for later use. I never sort of jump up and think, oh, I have to paint that, I have to draw that, you know. But I definitely keep note of things in my head. Most often, in the interests, if something's going to happen, you know, if it's an earthquake dream, I'll make a note of it because I think, you know, am I seeing something that's about to happen? You know, you have all these stories and accounts of people having dreams about 9/11 before it happened. And I find that fascinating. And it could be coincidence, you know, there's billions of people having dreams and millions of them will remember it. And hundreds of thousands of them will have horrible dreams and tens of thousands of them will be plane crashes, and you know, you sort of whittle it down and you think, well, yeah, there will have been people who inevitably would have had dreams that you could relate to it. So in terms of prophetic dreams, I try to write everything down just in case, because you never know.
That's a good idea.
That's very good. A lot of people always say that.
And you brought up 9/11. 3 days before 9/11 actually happened, we were living in Staten Island, New York, and I had a dream, and then I woke up and still in the dream, and the dream was planes crashing.
I told my wife,
I was like, this is just too real. It's too real. It doesn't make sense. And it stuck in my mind. And unfortunately, a few days later, I'm one of those people that did occur. And it's like one of those things where, and I say prophetic dreams because sometimes some of us, we dream ahead and that these things actually come into play in our own reality. Mm-hmm. And it's scary, but it's like you don't know how to take the message as well as, is it going to happen? Is it just a bad nightmare? Mm-hmm. You know, so you can't really, it's hard to separate
it. Very hard.
You know,
yeah.
Fact, it's going to happen versus fiction. It's just one of those dreams that, one of the millions of dreams that you have that don't mean anything.
It is an interesting one, isn't it? Because they say that all dreams seem to be is your brain, much in the way as I collect the information and put it in my own mental filing cabinet for later. Having a dream, they say, or especially a nightmare, is your brain dealing with what's happened that day or what you're currently going through that week. It's your own emotional base level, and your reptile brain is trying to fix everything and put it in order and make sense of it so that you can tackle it better the next day or when you've rested and fully absorbed all of the things that are going on. But in terms of time travel, perhaps, if these ideas and emotions are happening and there is no such thing as time, let's remember it's just a construct that we've put together as a measurement of the sun going around the earth. You know, time itself goes in every direction. If you would imagine that dreams could tap into any of those directions at any time. So is that what we're seeing? Are our brains kind of sorting out and cataloging things that have happened, but just not yet?
Yes. Interesting.
Mary.
So Rob Zombie, have you ever met him?
Oh, God.
Yeah, a couple of times. Yeah, super nice guy.
Want to know.
Yeah, what type of guy? It seems like a nice guy.
Yeah,
he's very together. He's very intelligent. He knows what he likes. And he's a super nice guy. You know, he's very knowledgeable on horror, of course. You know, it's his passion. And he lives and breathes it. And you can tell that's, you know, it's like when you meet someone who's so enthralled in what they love and they're living the dream, you know, it's nice to see, and it rubs off on his personality. You know, he is a fun person. He is snarky and comedic at times. But, you know, what can I say? For the few times I have met him, he's just been super nice. Yeah.
Great. Now, let's talk about your artwork that you have done.
No, I have to say, I started following you because we've had David Wedley on our show quite a few times, and I really started to look at your beautiful artwork, and that's when I really started to follow you. How you've done so many books for him. How was that experience for you, and how did you guys start working together?
Well, thank you. I honestly don't remember how it began. I think I may have messaged him to sort of say, hey, this is what I do, let's team up. But it was so long ago, it's years ago now. Gosh, many years ago.
You did his last book too, right?
I think I've done about 12 or 14 or something books now. I've lost count. I've done...
incredible.
He's working on a series of monster cryptozoology sort of guidebooks, if you will, for all the different states in America. So each book is a different state, and we're currently doing the 8th one. So that's going to be, you know, it's going to be a few years until we finish those, but there's 50 obviously, which will look nice on a bookshelf one day. So they're all on Amazon. And so it's a case of people are now collecting them. And as you say, you know, the book covers do help. Sort of sell, everything does, doesn't it? You know, they always say don't judge a book by its cover, but then how do you know what it's about? I've done his Bigfoot books and his books on the creepy dolls and strange intruders and black eyed kids. The Sasquatch Chronicles, yeah.
It's really nice. I'm echoing.
Yeah, so your artwork is really interesting.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up there.
I know. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just slightly. You're breaking up a little.
I don't know why.
Yeah, so let's really talk about, I want to talk about the artwork. And
sure.
Kiss. Well, you also have Kiss in your resume.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was they were a series of comic covers. The cover artwork that I did for IDW Publishing, and they had released a series of Kiss comic books. And I'd already done work with IDW Publishing for Judge Dredd and a few other things, Angel, 30 Days of Night, and you know, Mars Attacks, things like that. And they said, "Do you want to do some Kiss covers?" And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, it's Kiss." So I think I did 3 or 4, maybe 5 of those. But that was fun. You know, I've never met Kiss though.
But that was really good. That was nice that you did that though. That's cool. Dang. That's really nice.
Yeah, I do love Kiss. Who doesn't love Kiss?
Yeah, exactly.
So like you said, you were born in England. Do you think growing up there inspired you to become the artist that you are today?
Absolutely. You know, without sounding too proud, I am very proud that I'm British and I am English, and it's where my heart is. And I think one day I'll probably die there in a big mansion as some creepy old man. You know, I'll be the one that all the local kids are sort of terrified of, because I'll be the sort of curtain twitcher in this big old house, and the Goonies will be come, you know, the next generation of the Goonies will be coming to investigate my garden kind of thing. I love England. It is absolutely everything to me about who I am, yeah, in terms of growing up. You know, I'm 43 now, but I may have spent the last sort of 16 years or so in and out of Los Angeles. But I'm very much a Brit. Yeah. I think it's the history as well in England. You know, this London itself was founded 2,000 years ago, and I don't think a lot of people realize how old London is. London, you know, founded by the Romans 2,000 years ago. Wow. So England is steeped in history. People think, oh yeah, England's got a couple of hundred years on America. No, we've got a couple of thousand years. Yeah. And if you think of all of the different families and the factions and the wars that have gone through England between themselves, it's mind-blowing, which is, you know, probably why we're one of the most haunted countries in the world.
Isn't London the place where they'd have the underground catacombs of the skulls built up from the past? I think that's London.
There are a few places. There's mainly Prague and Paris have the catacombs. Mostly Paris have the real catacombs, which are huge, which go down several levels. But in London, we have the bubonic plague pits from the Black Death, where people were just, you know, thrown into giant holes in the ground as deep as they could to get rid of it all. They didn't know what to do. They would burn buildings down. They would bury people alive. It just awful because of this plague. And they've, you know, we have the oldest underground railroad in the world, and there are, you know, always plans to make new lower level railroads that go underneath the tube system. And the London Underground is infamous. You know, it's been in movies like American Werewolf in London. It's a creepy place.
Yeah.
And when they were, it was a number of years ago now, but when they were digging below the current underground system, the infamous London Underground, they went deeper and they found a new pit with 300 bodies in it, and skulls and just, you know, the remains of the bubonic plague. And people were thinking, you know, oh God, it's going to get out. We're all going to die again, which is just nonsense, because, you know, the bacteria would have died by now anyway. And we are so evolved and we have such a great immune system for the hundreds of years since that it wouldn't do anything to us now anyway, is the theory.
Yeah, that's what it is, a theory. Have you ever got a chance to visit any of the pyramids in Egypt?
I have not, no. Egypt's one of those places I'd love to go. I have many friends who've been, of course, and so I sort of drool over their photographs. But I've a friend who lives there and I've been invited over, so I may at some point when things have calmed down in our current pandemic situation, I'd love to take a trip out there, lose myself in the desert, maybe not actually lose myself, but you know.
Yeah, that's one of those places on my bucket list.
Is any of your artwork based on actual eyewitness accounts?
Everything. In terms of the cryptozoology and anything that I've touched on that's unexplained is generally based on real witness accounts. That's a great question, actually, because I was asked this the other day in terms of one of the Mothman illustrations I've done, is are they based on real witness accounts? And I'd say yes, because you know, you have artists that will exaggerate and embellish, and you have to sort of make things a little bit more interesting and dramatic and everything. But I come from a standpoint, especially with David Weatherly's book covers, where I look at it as natural history and natural history illustration. When I grew up in England, I would frequent the museums there, and I love the natural history museums in London and Manchester and, you know, of course, London. And I would see these, you know, illustrations of animals that are long extinct, and the artists who were portraying them on the walls or even in dinosaur books, you know, that my uncle would buy me. They always seemed to me to be trying to make them look as though they would look when they were alive. And so I kind of come from that standpoint in a natural history aspect, that if someone describes a Bigfoot to me, then I will base their descriptions and compare them on to the descriptions or what I know of living animals like gorillas and orangutans, and sort of, you know, see if there's any correlation of their description. And then, of course, just base it around that formula to give it the most realistic aspect and portrayal. I think if you exaggerate things and you add too much of your own spin, you do a disservice. And I would say that to any artist out there that's portraying the unexplained is don't twist it. Try and keep it as accurate as possible as you can. It's really important for future generations to sort of look back and say, oh, this is what they saw. Because I've thumbed through my collection of books of the unexplained, and I found these incredible stories, and I've seen these witness drawings. And the witness drawings are always really simple. You know, they're quite often they're done by people who don't draw. So they're very, very basic and stickman kind of. But occasionally you'll have pretty well practiced artists illustrating things, and they've done it in their own sort of style. And as I say, it does it a disservice to the facts, and it twists the story. And then the story becomes, as we say in England, Chinese whispers, or you would say telephone. You know, it's that game where things change over and over. So, I try and keep things as realistic as possible.
That's amazing. So do you ever, have you ever taught art? I mean, any classes or like as a teacher?
Yeah, I got my postgraduate certificate in education, and I taught for a year in England doing that, teaching fine art. And it was interesting because I sort of very quickly realized that it was something that I didn't want to do just yet, because I have you know, too many ambitions of my own and my own goals to sit in a studio and teach other people. You know, maybe I'll do that when I'm 60.
Yeah.
But for the, you know, for the next 20 years or so, I want to get out and do my own thing. So I'm not knocking teaching at all. I really enjoyed it. And as I say, you know, I did the course and got the qualifications to do that. And so it's a bullet on my belt that I will use later.
Yeah.
Rob Zombie, he's remaking the Monsters, the old TV show. He's making a movie.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really?
I've seen that. I was just wondering if you could do any artwork for that.
I would love to, but no, I am not involved. I believe he's having his wife, Sherry Moon, play Lily Monster, which which will be interesting. He's having the entire Monster's house rebuilt from scratch on a plot of land, and they're building the neighborhood itself as well with all the other houses. So he's hired, you know, a team of artists. There won't be one artist that works on it. There'll be several who will all have their place and they're all their own little individual positions, everything down to carpenters building the actual roofs of the houses. So that's pretty fascinating. I think it's going to be very accurate in terms of, you know, again, loyalty to the original TV series. I think this is going to be pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I've seen they're putting some clips out.
That's I didn't even see it.
Yeah. That's definitely going to be interesting. I hope you get involved with that somehow, you know, closer to the date that you do some artwork for them as well.
Yeah. If I have time.
If you have time, you know. So let's talk about the Black Eyed Children. Oh. And, you know, because you talked about David Weatherly and some of the work you've done for him. And I know, you know, he has a lot of thought into that. What do you think about the Black Eyed Children?
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because, you know, as you say, David's done an incredible amount of research on it, and he's found that these stories go back way, way before the first, modern accounts that we have, the famous ones that we'll have heard on several other podcasts and radio shows where someone will open the door and there'll be a child there with black eyes. And I don't mean they've been punched. I mean, you know, the sclera is black. They don't have any whites in their eyes. It's just black. And they'll say strange things that don't seem to fit a normal way of speaking. They'll say things like, you know, it's food time. And they'll ask to come into the house, and they can't come in without permission, or they can't get into your car without permission, but they insist that you do that for them and that you have to do it. And they have this very oppressive, ominous tone to them. And they always seem to be dressed kind of odd. Maybe it looks as though they're wearing clothes that don't quite fit, or they're from another era. So it's interesting. What's going on there? Are they vampires? Are they aliens? Are they ghosts? You know, what people would blanket the term demons, you know, which covers everything to a lot of people. You know, what are they? What's going on there? I have no idea. it's a real
documented in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I hope that all I have been doing that.
Yeah.
Especially if we don't have dinner ready on the table and they want to eat and they're kind of hungry.
Oh man.
But look, there are people out there say, no, this is real. Yeah. I've seen these children. I've seen them. And you know, and in different states, again, is it one big hoax or is it there's truth to it? You know, or are they the time travelers?
It's like everything else.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that sort of fall into that category. And there are a lot of, you know, witness accounts where, as you say, in one culture, they'll call it something different, but essentially it's the same thing. People talk about the djinn. Evil genies or whatever you want to call them, you know, the other race that's jealous of people. Is it them? Is it something that we don't really have a name for, you know, that we don't really know what it is? So we're just using the term black eyed kids because we don't actually know what to call them because they don't have a name.
Yeah, that's true. We don't have a terminology for them.
It's odd. Yeah. It's very odd. I'm sure there's a lot of pranks out there. There's a lot of, you know, people playing on it. And it's obviously much in the same way as people faking Bigfoot. You know, it's only going to increase the witness accounts. And I'm sure that there's been people just, you know, playing with people, pranking people, trick or treat style, but every day of the year, because kids get bored and it's fun.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what happened with the crop circles. You know, it hits the news, and then all of a sudden, a few days later, they see that how it was done with the board and the rope and how they plan, you know, and it kind of steers away from the truth and the reality of the possibilities of these things actually being around. And that goes the same with Bigfoot, right?
There's a lot of imitation of Bigfoot. Yes. Now, I think I read somewhere that you've done a lot of research on Bigfoot. Is it true that you've traveled around searching for him?
Yeah. I think everybody's an armchair researcher these days, you know, me included, thanks to the internet. People can sit at home and read endless amounts of information. I think the problem is too many people swallow that information as fact, and they don't compare and contrast evidence. And there is a lot of evidence out there that isn't real, as well as the stuff that is. You know, you can't exclude that the footprints are very, very real. I think Sir David Attenborough once said, nobody's going to climb 9,000 feet up a mountain to fake a footprint on the off chance that someone might see it. You know, there are footprints out there that have been made by very real creatures. What they are, who knows? I tend to think that they're on the family tree of humans. They're an offshoot. They're probably an uncatalogued, you know, species of human, which just happens to be larger and hairier, much like the, you know, extinct forms that we have in other parts of the world. In South Africa, we have Australopithecus, which is this 9-foot-tall human type, you know, creature that people have described in Australia as well. And in northern Russia, you have things that are described as Neanderthal-looking. And you think to yourself, well, of all the different races of people on the planet, and we're also varied, and there's several different types of chimpanzee and gorilla as well. You know, a different type of gorillas discovered in the last decade or so, and the Billy ape as well, which is a 5-foot-tall upright walking chimpanzee that was a myth until about 10 years ago. These things are constantly being discovered, and they're very large animals. New deer, new whales, new giant reptiles and monitor lizards are being found every year. And I think in terms of Bigfoot, what people don't realize is just how vast the United States and Canada is, that hasn't been discovered. It hasn't had paved concrete put on it. In fact, we've only modernized and urbanized, if you will, in terms of roads and cities and towns. We've only done 5% of the United States. 95% of the states is wilderness. And you're talking mountains and deserts for endless miles, and forests, some of which are rainforests. Up in Oregon and even Texas, you have very humid, swampy areas down in the south. It's a jungle out there, and I don't think people realize that you can compare it to Africa. It's, you know, Africa isn't its own singular little jungle country or continent. It's, you know, same with Australia. You know, it's a vast amount of land that we have not put foot on. And I think once people wrap their head around that, it's a lot easier to accept that there are large, upright walking ape men, if you like, walking around that are actively avoiding us. And they do it very well because they've been doing it for thousands of years, which is probably how they've survived. Because we know, in, you know, from our own history, that we outbred and we outcompeted the Neanderthal man, and we lived alongside them. We didn't evolve from them in different species. We all came from the same lineage way, way, way back, but at some point on this family tree, we split off and went into two different factions and many others, which also died out or moved away or traveled around the world and became, you know, other things and then died off. and it seems that only Homo sapien has survived. I find it hard to believe that we are the only ones. I tend to think that there has to be another small pocket of survivors out there of another species, and I think maybe that's what it is.
You know, what's also interesting is that the depths of the ocean, you know, we talked about land, we talked about the depths and of the ocean, like what's down there. You know, we talk about apparitions or ghosts or Bigfoot up here, but who knows what's existing down there?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a great one. We know more about the moon than we do about our own ocean. It's been said many times, we know more about space than our own oceans. And we've been to the bottom of the ocean, but only in certain places. We haven't covered the entire floor, and we don't know where those cracks and crevices go. We don't know if you know, there are pockets underneath the very bottom of the ocean. There could be another level below that. We don't know. And so, you know, that ties into the UFOs and the USOs and people seeing flying saucers literally bomb into the ocean and disappear or come out of the ocean. There's countless, you know, records of the Navy encountering lights and balls of light and strange craft coming in and out of the ocean. One of them, I forget the name of the ship, but a huge disc came up out of the ocean very slowly next to the ship and in fact dented it before it shot off into the sky. It sort of, you know, scraped along the side of the boat as it came out of the sea and then shut off. And this happened, you know, these are things that are on record. You can look them up. And we don't have the technology, certainly not the human survival capabilities to go down to such depths because the pressure is just so immense that, it's a perfect hiding space for, you know, an alien spacecraft or a time traveling spacecraft or an interdimensional doorway, whatever it is, to hide down there. There's so much room. We can't go there. You know, we can barely go to space, but we can go to space. We can't go to the bottom of the ocean. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I know. And then they say that it could be another country, but that's not possible, Russia or China. Because quite frankly, if anyone had that technology, we would have known about it years ago. I think it's just all hidden, and maybe the governments do know what's going on. You know, maybe they do. I mean, look, we have satellites in the sky. I'm sure that they can't be that senile and so to speak, that say, you know, they have to know something we don't know.
Like everything.
Yeah. Like we get a bit of the truth. I feel like you just said about the UFO coming out of the ocean. That was a few months ago. They came out with all the big shots, came out and showed that clip with the Navy. So then what? What's after that? You notice how it just drops off the news after a while. They don't want to talk about it because the big wigs up on top put the hush hush button so that no one does want to talk about it. Because, oh, yeah, well, that was then and that's not today's news. That was yesterday and we really don't care about it. But thankfully, there are some people out there that are keeping it going because, quite frankly, I think that there could be a tie-in to the things that we don't know if we did have that information out public.
Yeah. I think in terms of the government, you know, even if you go, as they would say, to the top and you consider the chief in the whole of the military, you know, the president of the United States himself, people sort of blame whoever is in that seat at the time with any disaster that's going on. It's always their fault. And we know that that's not the case. We know that... you know, it's a seat and it's a face.
Yeah.
It's a celebrity position in a sense. They do make decisions, of course, and they do their jobs. However, they also have a team of advisors. They have generals. They have hundreds upon hundreds of government workers around the clock, constantly preening and pruning and putting things through in paperwork. It's, you know, it's a job no one person can do. And so I also think in terms of UFOs or UAPs, as they've tried to sort of now bring in this new term to make it sound as though they're actually taking it seriously just by renaming it. Nothing has changed, as you say. And I think in part it's because those who are in power, the ones who are running the government, and I would say that you could split it down the middle. There's the unseen, as Richard Dolan would say, the breakaway civilization. There's the ones with the money that have their own laws that will give the trickle-down effect, and you know, they weave the webs in a sense. And then you have the government that we see that are running the show that we will also never, ever get to speak to or really know who's running. And so you have the breakaway society that's sort of even beyond the government that we don't even see, who are probably the ones that have their own islands and their own flying cars and who knows what, you know. And we have our government that are, I think, for the most part, running around like headless chickens because they actually don't know what's going on. 100%, they literally do not have a clue. And I think it's inevitable that there are technologies out there flying around that are the US, that are China, that are Russia. And I do think we're beyond the Cold War. I think people do share technology. I do think that it would be incredibly difficult to keep a lid on something, especially these days. Leaks are coming inside from all kinds of different areas and different people for and against, you know, it always has, you know, it's the same thing with the Second World War, you know, you have your double agents and everything. But with the government hiding the fact that they're flying their own super aircraft is inevitable. They've done it in the past with the Blackbird, that was flying around over Russia, taking photographs, avoiding radar for 30 years before they announced that they had it. You know, People were describing this pointy black Concorde looking craft that would be just ridiculously fast. And of course it was, and it was the Blackbird. And they did that for 30 years before we knew. And that was the Americans. So it's not a stretch of the imagination to believe that 50 years on, you know, half a century later, to say that we're not flying something more advanced is really naive. I think it's inevitable. It's obvious. Some would say that maybe we've reached a point in technology where we've sort of hit a wall and we're waiting for the next breakthrough because there's nothing else we can do. I would argue that we are behind the scenes developing things that the general public probably hasn't even thought of. And the rate and the speed that technology is advancing, even in the home computer, you know, the family computer that 20 years ago nobody had. 20 years ago nobody had cell phones. 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, YouTube didn't exist. You know, we didn't have Facebook or MySpace or Twitter or Instagram. None of this existed 20 years ago. And well, it is
my fault. I mean, back in the 80s, who would ever think there'd be a cell phone?
Never.
Yeah.
Nope.
The ones that came out, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, it looked like a brick. It was a heavy phone.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and
that.
You needed a lot of money just to activate it. But, hey, you're a great guest. We're at the top of the hour. Where can people find you, and what do you have going on?
Well, you can find me at Mr. Sam Sheeran. .com. All my links are on there. All the socials are on there. Print store, you know, Patreon, all that kind of thing. So that's Mr. MISTER. And then Sam, as in Uncle Sam. And Sheeran, SHEARON. And currently I'm just working on book covers for David Weatherly and a few other secret special projects that will be coming out around Halloween.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much for coming on Ghost Fly Chronicles Radio.
Amazing,
this was really quick and so much to cover in a short little amount of time.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, Julie, wrap it up.
All right, well, we want to have a special thank you to Carnation for fully sponsoring the show. We love them. Please join us next Monday night on the United Public Radio Network on 105.3 FM from New Orleans. And stay tuned for the Angel Rock with the amazing Laura.
And really quick, everyone, you can see the Horsefly Chronicles episode Wrestling with Ghosts on ASY TV now playing. Everybody wanted it. You wanted to see what we caught. They were here. Yeah. They caught it. It's out there. All right, everyone. Have a great night.
Thank you, Sam. Have an amazing night.
We'll catch you next week.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.